Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Here's a heads up for students. It's back to school in a mere 40 days or so. But for folks at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, the transition from summer vacation to the classroom has already begun. In the past, the challenge for administrators has been to fill teaching and other positions in time for that first day of school, making sure classrooms and school buildings are in good shape and more. Those issues remain, but this year some new concerns have emerged. Funding for schools, which is a perennial issue for North Carolina public schools, has become even more of a challenge. The federal government recently announced that they are freezing $7 billion in education funding. $165 million of those funds were earmarked for North Carolina, which means a shortfall of $12 million for CMS. And this could mean understaffing classroom support positions or incurring about $1 million in monthly debt to maintain that staffing. Last year, absenteeism among Hispanic students rose because of fear of ICE operations in our area. With those efforts ongoing and potentially ramping up, the problem is anticipated to increase. Educators here and around the country are trying to figure out how best to use artificial intelligence in the classroom, what to do about cell phones, how to solve the problem of chronic absenteeism in all student populations, which arose from the pandemic, guns in school, drugs in school, and more. It's a lot to talk about with CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill, but she's here for the hour, and we'll work our way through much of it, if not all of it. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good morning. So good excited morning. To be here with you.
I'll dispel you of that in moments. Every year, you and others in the school administration face the challenge of filling teacher vacancies and cafeteria worker vacancies and bus driver vacancies in advance of the opening day of school. Much of that has been driven by lower than desirable teacher pay and some other factors. But I'm told you're ahead of the game this year. Where do you stand today?
Yes, right now, last year we had a fill rate of 99%. This year, we are currently sitting at 96% fill rate for our teachers, which is about 368 vacancies. But I want to note that 118 of them are currently in process of being hired. So we are in really great shape.
So last year, if I understand this correctly, you opened schools with 276 vacancies. How quickly did that improve the year? And what is the impact of that? You have 276 classrooms empty, devoid of a teacher.
Yes, that's correct. But, you know, we have a large school system. So 186 schools, you divide that out. It seems like a large number, but it isn't. But schools work very hard to make sure that they have coverage plans. We are always thinking about the worst case scenario and having a plan to address. So if that means collapsing classrooms or providing additional support from teacher leaders that are in the building, things like that.
Public schools, according to public school officials and the courts in North Carolina, are chronically underfunded. But teacher pay has been rising. The state increased that amount of money earmarked for teacher salaries several times in the recent past. I believe the local supplement has also increased over the last several years. How far away are we, in your opinion, from teacher salaries being where they need to be in order to be competitive with other industries that these very smart individuals could be working in should they not choose to be a teacher?
Yeah, so I think we can look at other industries, but I think more importantly, we need to look at surrounding states. So take our neighbor, South Carolina, that's not too far from Charlotte, and where their pay is sitting in addition to other surrounding states. So I think before we start thinking about other industries, as a state, we need to get really serious about being competitive. I am so proud that in North Carolina, we're number one for business. And I'm a strong believer that K-12 education is all about workforce development. So if we want to continue being number one in business, we need to get serious about how we pay our teachers.
Teacher pay is one factor in both attracting and retaining good teachers in the classroom, but there are other factors as well. The livable wage obviously has to come first, because if you can't afford to eat or find an apartment to live in or a home to live in, then you really can't work here. And that's a problem. And I know that CMS and other entities in municipal government are working to find workforce and teacher housing that is affordable for those folks. But is it just money? In other words, do we give teachers the moral support, et cetera, that they need outside of the money?
Mike, that's a great call out. Money is important, obviously, to have a livable wage, but the way that we honor our teachers, the way that we respect them, the way that we develop and train them and set them up for success is incredibly important. We did that here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. I made a key decision to remove a position that was our chief academic officer, Nancy Brightwell, who had been with the district well over 30 years, and put her over recruitment, retention, and talent development. And I just want to share with you quickly the stats of all the work that she's done. So our teacher turnover is down 4% from 18% to 14%. Our beginning teacher turnover rate in the past has been 23%. Last year, it was 8%. And I think it speaks very closely to the things that you pointed out, that teacher pay is a critical factor, but there's so much more that goes into making sure that our teachers feel cared for, that they're appreciated, that they're that we are respectful of them and really appreciate all the great things they do for our students and for our community.
Last year, the General Assembly voted into law an expansion of the Opportunity Scholarship Program, which allows every student in the state a stipend to attend a private school. This goes to everyone, no matter the income level of their parents. So parents who have already enrolled their children in private schools because they can afford to do so will get this money, even though they don't really need this money. And lower income people who do need this money to go to private school will get this money, although it may not pay the full freight of that private school education. So they'll, many of them, not have that choice to go to private schools. They'll be in the public schools. What do you see as the potential impact to CMS and other public school systems around the state from funneling this money for education away from public schools and into a different direction?
Well, it's definitely problematic. I believe EdNC released a report with the actual numbers of students that were enrolled in public schools who made a decision to go to private schools based on the scholarships, and there was not a lot of impact. But what we do know is that those public dollars are now leaving public education and going into private education. The thing that I believe is most concerning is that they're public dollars, right, that are collected the same way, but the way that they're dispersed and the accountability for those dollars is quite different. Schools have accountability. I don't have a problem and shy away from accountability. I think it makes you stand up a little taller. But if it's public dollars that are being used for public education and there's accountability, that same level of accountability, or shucks, just a little bit of accountability should be in place. To my knowledge, there is zero accountability for our hard-earned tax dollars that are going to fund students to attend private schools.
And this is not just private schools. It includes the charter schools. And every superintendent of education at CMS has always been, I don't want to call them cheerleaders for charter schools, but they've always said, oh, no, we welcome the charter schools. But the money for those schools comes from CMS. So, and they don't have the same level of accountability. And this seems to be a trend. I've been doing the show a long time. This seems to be a trend within the state to move money away from public schools into schools that have little to no accountability. Do you understand what's going on here?
Well, charter schools are public schools.
But they're not.
Yes.
They don't have to provide lunch. They don't have to provide transportation. They're on a different playing field.
You are correct. The playing field is not equal. I do believe that it should be equal. It is problematic, and it's the funding model is problematic. The accountability model for all of the entities is problematic. But, you know, I think that as a leader, you can make a decision. You can cry about it, or you can figure out how do we ensure that every single one of our schools is the very best and that parents want to bring their child to our schools. And we are seeing that in terms of our increasing enrollment. Again, there was a recent report that stated that Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools will be one of the schools that has a really huge hike in terms of student enrollment in the near future.
But these opportunity scholarships have changed the paradigm a little bit, I guess, and we won't really know exactly how probably until sometime well into this school year and maybe into next. But this money is being offered to everybody. Not everybody will choose to take it. Some people are happy with the public school that their child is enrolled in and with the teachers in their classrooms. Some people will take it and maybe find that it's still not doable for them, so they'll come back. But what do you think the economic impact of this will be to CMS?
Well, it's definitely a negative economic impact. And you've called out several things, and I like to think of it as death by a thousand cuts. You start chiseling away here, you're pulling public dollars and putting them into private education, you're defunding public schools, there's a crisis with federal funding. And then at the end of the day, local government is, they have the brunt of the responsibility. So it becomes very difficult, and it's not positive. So there's a lot of moving pieces. And so when you think about how public schools are funded, in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, we have about 55% is from state, 34% is local, and 6% is federal. But what people don't understand is how all three of those things work together for the complete funding model. So when you start cutting here, diverting here, pulling here, at the end of the day, it has a negative impact for sure.
Is this death by a thousand cuts, which is coming from the state level and the federal level and other levels as well, I suppose, in depending upon which district or state you're in, is this purposeful, or is this something that is happening because people just don't understand the bigger picture?
I think it's probably a combination of both. I think that there's a push for there to be other options. I am not against parents having options. As a parent, I believe that parents are their child's first and best advocate, and they have a right to choose the education that is best for their child. And public schools are funded with public dollars. And if public schools are funded with pu public dollars and there's a set of rules and accountability, if you're gonna throw the dollars out there to every entity, the rules of the game have to be the same. If not, there is inherent inequities that will occur.
And now that public funds are being used for private and sometimes religious schools, because the parents can take that pot of money that the state is giving them and use it for those educations, do you see a day when similar rules and accountability that applies to you will be applied to them, or is it simply a money grab?
I can't predict the future. I can't predict the future. I can't imagine a world in which others have the same accountability model that we do.
When it comes to funding, when we come back from the break, we're going to start with some good news because that is the fact that CMS received its full funding from the Mecklenburg County Commission for your requested budget increase. It's an additional $28 million. It brings your total funding from the county, at least, to an evil number, $666.1 million, or 4.4% over last year. But Mecklenburg County is not your only source of funding. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about federal funding cuts, which are looming large for public schools around the country. We'll talk about artificial intelligence, ICE concerns, and more with Dr. Crystal Hill when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Dr. Crystal Hill, Superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, in advance of the first day of school, which is right around the corner next month. I mentioned that you were fully funded. Your request for funding was fully funded, granted by the Mecklenburg County Commission. You're getting an additional $28 million, or 4.4% more than you did last year. But Mecklenburg County is not the only source of funding for CMS. 53.8% comes from the state, 8.4% at the moment comes from the federal government, and Mecklenburg County's portion amounts to about 34.5%. When you put them all together, are you getting what you need, what you asked for?
Well, Mecklenburg County government has been extremely gracious in their support. This is our third year of a fully funded budget, and I think that is definitely a testament to the way that our boards are working more closely and collaboratively together, as well as me, our staff, and their staff. Is it what we need? Absolutely not. Entering into this budget season, we knew that we were going to be facing some revenue challenges from all three of our funding sources, from the state, federal, and local angles. So we had to really look internally and make some pretty serious cuts in order to move forward. But we wanted to make sure that we prioritized two things. Number one, the classroom experience. Throughout this entire budget season, I have said that we are going to preserve the classroom experience for our students. And then the second was a focus on our people. We want to do everything possible that we do not reduce our people that are just absolutely amazing.
We kind of touched on this prior to the break, and so at the risk of backing up and repeating some things that we've already talked about, I do want to share this email that we just got from Annette, who says, "My children attend Charlotte Catholic, and the administration sent an email out to all the parents highly encouraging us to enroll for the education funds." That's the Opportunity Scholarship Funds. "We enrolled, and we were in the top tier for earning income. I can tell you almost everybody I've spoken to has received money from the public fund, and we were all paying just perfectly fine without it. It pains me that I am receiving money to fund my child's private school education and that this money isn't going to our public schools. However, I know that if I refused the money, it would just go to somebody else who didn't need it. It is a sham." Those are her words, not mine. So moving on. That's just one thing dealing with money that we've been talking about. The next one is the Trump administration. They're working toward closing down the U.S. Department of Education. This is a department that was established by the Carter administration with congressional approval and funding, and Trump has essentially been given the okay by the Supreme Court to dismantle the agency. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing him to lay off nearly 1,400 Education Department employees, which one federal judge has said will likely, quote, cripple the department. Because Republicans, since Ronald Reagan, have positioned their desire to shut down that department as returning control of education back to the states, some people have come to believe that Washington bureaucrats have been telling local schools how to teach and what to teach. And that is not the case. From your point of view, what has been the role of the Department of Education, and how important have they become to public schools?
Yeah, I think what the U.S. Department of Public Education has done is taken a look at specific factors, primarily students that don't have access, and provide supplemental funding to make sure that there's not an opportunity to supplant what is already happening in schools, but providing additional funding for students that absolutely need it. Said differently, states provide a base level of funding. The role of the federal Department of Education at the federal level has been to supplement what's already happening, making sure that the students that need additional support actually get them.
So they're not telling you, use this textbook. Don't teach this.
Absolutely
teach
not.
That. Setting absolutely up the curriculum. They're not doing that.
They're absolutely not. They are a funding source. We are governed in North Carolina by the North Carolina Standard Course of Study. That is what we are contractually required to teach. There is a process by which those standards are set. It is all public facing in terms of collecting public feedback, and that is what we are required to teach.
The idea that the Department of Education has been controlling what your children learn in classrooms around the country has been around since Ronald Reagan. Why has that message taken hold? Why have educators not been able to counter that message with something more accurately describing what they do?
Well, I think there's a great question. That's a great question. I think what happens is in any industry, in any sector, things happen that are not appropriate, right? There are things that happen in every when you go to the hospital, you might have a negative experience. When you might have a negative experience with the police, you might have a negative experience in your classroom, but with what's happening in your classroom. Well, then that gets spun into, well, it must have come from here. And so we need to get rid of that. And that couldn't be further from the truth. What we receive from the federal government is, again, funding to make sure that we are supplementing the funds that we are already receiving at the state and local level.
So you may not be able to answer this question, but if the main purpose of the U.S. Department of Education has been to direct money to the states and for the public schools and not control what textbooks are used or what books are in the library or what courses will be taught and what will not be taught, why would the loss of 1,400 employees or the entire department hurt our schools? Is it just amount of money? Is it money that cannot be replaced and will not be replaced by the states?
Yeah, I can't really answer that direct question because I don't know what positions have been dismantled, but I will tell you from a personal standpoint, I have a education loan. Well, I tried to reach out to the Department of Ed to ask a question about my loan. They told me the wait, you get the recording, the wait will be 9 hours and 42 minutes. I mean, give me a break, right? The loss that I felt personally is the opportunity to efficiently ask a question about loan that debt that I've incurred through the Department of Education through the form of a loan, asking a question about my loan.
The president and CEO of Democracy Forward has said that this Supreme Court decision that allows the Trump administration to lay off these workers has, quote, dealt a devastating blow to this nation's promise of public education for all children. Is that an exaggeration? What would be the impact of completely eliminating the Department of Education, in your opinion?
Well, I think the what is problematic in, again, I can't speak to exactly what positions have been
Well, he wants
removed.
to eliminate it. He wants to shut it down. And so does the director of the Department of Education, who was appointed knowing that her job was going to be to close the doors.
Right. So I think the impact would be chaos, right? When you have something that's been an establishment for decades and it all of a sudden goes away, it creates mass chaos. And so at the school level, at the district level, at the state level, everybody gets into a swirl. You don't know what's happening, when it's happening, why it's happening. And that, of course, takes our focus off of what it should be, and that's educating our children. So, again, I don't want to speak to the way things are done, but anytime you're making that level of decision, one would think that you do it incrementally so people understand what's happening, why it's happening, and what the direct impact will be. I think the impact right now is nobody knows, which is a major problem. What we do know is that there are dollars that we are going that are right now are being frozen. So that's the direct impact right now. And we have school that's starting in a few weeks.
Yes.
So
Well, let's
instead
talk
of
about
focusing
that. Let's
on
talk
getting
about that
everybody hired, we're in a swirl.
because that's illustrative of the chaos that you're talking about. 2 weeks ago, to quote North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson, out of the blue, those are his words, North Carolina received a three-sentence email from the U.S. Department of Education saying that $165 million in funding scheduled to arrive the next day was being indefinitely frozen. That $165 million is our state's portion of the $7 billion that the Trump administration is freezing nationally. CMS was scheduled to receive $12 million of that money, and Jeff Jackson said the impact of the withholding of these funds will be severe. Do you agree?
Absolutely, 100%. There was rumblings about the possibility of this funding going away, probably January, February, March or so. However, we received what we receive every single year from the federal government and then in turn through the state, which is called our planning allotment. And so basically what that is based on your current data that they pull from a point in time in the year. They say, this is probably what your allocation will be. We use that information in the formulation of our budget because we are required statutorily to have our budget presented and approved by boards of education that goes to our local county government. That's all based on an assumption. And so, of course, part of that assumption is how much state money we're going to get and how much federal money we were going to get. So, at the time we submitted our budget and at the time we asked our board to approve our federal dollars, we had in hand what was presented to us as our, what we call our planning allotment. So, what Mr. Jackson, Attorney Jackson, said is true. We got the email, it's frozen.
So the immediate consequences, I think this would be accurate to say, pose a kind of Sophie's choice for you at CMS. You may either be forced to understaff classroom support positions and certain services like after-school care, summer learning, and support for English learners, and or take on about $1 million in debt per month to keep that going. How will students, parents, teachers, how will they be directly impacted if this freeze holds?
Absolutely. So I spoke a little bit to we knew that potentially this might be an issue. So we took some very deliberate steps throughout our budget process in terms of tightening up, not fully allocating, for example, all of our Title I funds, even though we know that Title I funds would not be directly impacted. We knew that we may have to pull from Title I to address these other areas. So we have, had to go back and start working through some of those things. The concern is because we made those deliberate steps, we are going to have to cut some things this year with the promise that we're trying so hard not to impact people and the classroom experience. The devastating impact may not happen this school year, but it will definitely happen next school year.
Well, Attorney General Jeff Jackson says that if this freeze of funding isn't reversed soon, about, quote, 1,000 educators in our state could lose their jobs just weeks before the start of school. And even though CMS is taking the biggest hit of all the schools in the state, which we'll talk about in a second, it will be the rural schools who suffer the most from this, which is why he joined a group of attorneys general from around the country, I think 20 states in all, suing the U.S. Department of Education because he says these cuts are not just harmful, they are illegal because the U.S. Department of Education does not have the authority to override the congressional approval that led to the appropriation of these funds. And in a YouTube message to voters, he added this.
If Congress wants to eliminate those programs, they can do that, and we can debate whether that's a good idea. But once those funds have been approved, the department that's supposed to give them to the states can't just go, nah, we're not going to do that. That's why this is such a straightforward case that I think we should win, and I suspect the department agrees. I think they know they're going to lose in court, and I think they're fine with that. I think they're looking to score some points with a small group of people who want to see them taking action and being tough, and then they get to blame the court when they get blocked.
In other words, education has become yet another political football. Do you understand why?
It's interesting that you use that term. One thing that I have vowed since I stepped into this role is that I was not going to allow Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools to be a political football, which goes back to what I said earlier about making sure that we're staying focused. There are a million reasons why that might be the case, but my promise and my commitment to our students, our staff, our community is to stay focused on what I get paid to do, and that's to put our students first, to put our staff first, to put our community first, and make sure they have the very best education possible.
Some of the quiet parts are being said out loud now. Things that you would be disqualifying in the past are no longer disqualifying, and they're just telling you what they're going to do, and they're going to do it. And other parts of this seem to be a little more surreptitious. But when you put them all together, a pattern has emerged over time. These cuts, along with underfunding of our schools by Republican-controlled legislatures around the country, and their expansion here in North Carolina of the Opportunity Scholarships, are couched as efforts to return control to the states and control to the parents to give them choice. But some view this as an attack on public education, an attempt to weaken and eventually destroy it. How do you view it?
Well, you know, I think that there's opportunity to achieve the goals of giving parents choice, but doing it in a way that is thoughtful, in a way that's deliberate, in a way that's equitable. And so I think that is what my biggest concern is that the things that are happening, and we've, you know, talked a lot about this earlier in terms of the funding model and the accountability models, that they are not equitable. And I think that is what is most problematic. And at the end of the day, you know, specifically with this, with these cuts, as I mentioned, the current cuts, the 12.5 million, we may not see really bad crisis this year, but as we head into the next year, it will be devastating, not just to specific groups of students, but every single student in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, because we have to start for funding.
Because some have said that if these cuts remain permanent, it could ultimately impact not only academic performance, especially for vulnerable populations. It will hurt teacher morale. It will hurt hiring efforts and likely increase the difficulty in retaining good teachers. Plus, families who rely on certain programs like meals in schools, transportation to and from school, may find themselves in the lurch. Is that accurate?
It's 100% accurate. The reality is that our teachers, our principals, our school staff already have a really tough job. We talked all about that. So in essence, we will be asking our people to do more with less resources. And the impact of that, you know, to our students, to our staff, is just devastating because they already work so hard, they're so dedicated, and they're so committed. So it definitely, you know, everything that you said is 100% true.
So CMS is possibly going to lose $12 million this year if these funds remain frozen. Wake County Schools, $8 million. Guilford County Schools, $4.6 million. We take the biggest hit of any system in the state. But as I said, Jeff Jackson, the Attorney General, says the rural schools will be hurt the most because they don't get enough money to begin with. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board has sent a letter to the Department of Education asking them to revise their decision. I have 20 seconds left. Have you received a response?
My knowledge, no.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about something else being enacted by the federal government that is having an impact, already has had an impact on public schools here and around the country, and which may have an even greater impact, and that is concerns over ICE. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. Our guest today, Dr. Crystal Hill, Superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, in advance of the first day of school coming up in August. Last year, absenteeism among Hispanic students began to rise in the shadow of fears being raised by ICE raids in our area. We reported on WFAE of several arrests of allegedly undocumented individuals being arrested near schools, not on campuses, but near schools. One involved a parent who was taking their child to school. Am I correct in saying that ICE has not yet come onto any CMS school campus?
That is 100% correct.
So CMS principals are now required to take an immigration webinar clarifying what to do if immigration officials appear on a school campus. What are they supposed to do?
Absolutely. So one thing that I want you and the public to know is that we began these efforts through our Office of General Counsel with information to our school principals last August. And we have continued to share updates and information as things changed. But in terms of what they are supposed to do when anyone comes on campus, they're required to verify their credentials. And if they're there to speak with anyone or, you know, whatever action they're asking to take, they're asked to provide specific documentation. Our principals are not asked to interpret that documentation because they're not attorneys. So they send it over to our Office of General Counsel, they verify it, send it back, and then they have specific steps in terms of what to do next.
These ICE agents that we've been witnessing on television arresting people, apparently indiscriminately in some cases, including United States senators, and pushing them to the floor, are masked. They wear very little, if any, identification. They don't show their badge. They don't show warrants to arrest people or detain those people. They just hustle them off and put them in an unmarked car and take them away. Do you think that ICE coming into a school is going to abide by your regulations?
Well, I have faith in believing that they would.
Why?
Let me just say that whoever our ICE agents are, I believe that they're human. And I believe that every person, hopefully, still understands how precious our most vulnerable population is, and that's our children.
And what about what you witnessed? And most of us have only witnessed this in television news reports.
Correct. What
about what you have witnessed would lead you to believe that what you said has a scintilla of truth?
Well, I guess what I would say is that it hasn't happened yet. And to my knowledge, I'm not sure where it's happened anywhere else in a K-12 setting.
Well, the Trump administration canceled a Biden administration policy of the Department of Homeland Security, which designated schools as protected areas. That designation is now gone. And when WFAE reached out to CMS for comment, they said this is not a new rule, the one that you've just enacted, because ICE agents and other members of the public are permitted in public areas of schools. If ICE does not present a verifiable warrant, though, can you legally stop them? Do you have the manpower even to stop them from entering a classroom or boarding a school bus and either interviewing, talking to, scaring, carting away a student or a staff member?
Of course we don't. And I think that would be the case for any organization. But we know what the law is. We plan to follow the law, and we have continued to inform our staff, inform our parents. We pride ourselves in making sure that our schools are safe. And we have been very clear about what is in place and what we will follow. One thing that I think is important to note is that as educators, we are required to provide all students with the free public education. We are not allowed to know the immigration status of any student. So if anyone comes on campus, you know, and starts asking questions about a student's immigration status, we're not allowed to collect that information at the time of enrollment. We have no idea who those students are.
And as I understand it, it is your policy that teachers cannot volunteer that information.
That is correct.
If they know that, what's the penalty for volunteering that information if in fact they know that information?
Yeah, well, it'd definitely be a violation of our board policy. It would also be a violation of the Educator Code of Ethics. That information is called personally identifiable information. And there is a long list of things that we are not allowed to share: student's name, parent's name, address, telephone number, migrant status, homeless status, or their English language proficiency level.
You have produced a document titled Immigration, Educational Rights, and Educator Guide, which recommends that if a parent is deported or faces another type of enforcement, that school staff should consider connecting the student with a counselor. And it says that staff cannot, as I said, voluntarily report the status of students to law enforcement or give legal advice to families. Is that enforceable under the First Amendment?
Which part?
All of it.
Are you talking about having us? I guess I'm not clear on your question, Mike. I'm sorry.
Okay. They're not allowed to voluntarily report students' status.
First
of all, that's free speech. So that's the First Amendment.
As a school employee, they're not protected. Okay. In free speech in that area because it is the student's information. They are not.
For all the reasons that we've talked about, the Hispanic absentee rate was up last year. Given the increase in ICE activities around the country, do you anticipate a higher rate of absenteeism this year? Do you expect ICE to become more active near or on your campuses?
Well, we are certainly monitoring the activity that's happening in our area and then making specific strategic moves. We work very closely with all of our students and all of our schools in terms of making sure that attendance is prioritized. One thing that I would want to say is that I know what we see on TV, but I think it is very short-sighted for us to assume that any person who's living in the country who is undocumented happens to be Hispanic. I think that's just a terrible thought. We have 55,000 students in our district who speak a language other than English as their first language. And the rising number of those students is actually Russian, is the language that they're speaking. So I think it is, you know, you can't confuse undocumented status with students that speak English language, but somehow those things all get lumped together. So I just want us to be really thoughtful in the way that we are thinking about these issues and the sensitivity behind it.
I know that you've been concerned about rising absenteeism since the pandemic. A lot of students didn't attend the virtual classes and then didn't come back. And that's a problem in and of itself. But if absenteeism rises because of fears about ICE activities and parents not wanting to leave home, even with their children, because they might be picked up and deported, are there plans in place by CMS to offer alternative educational opportunities to these kids who are afraid to come to a schoolroom?
Well, not at this time. Currently, students that receive virtual education have to be enrolled in a virtual school. So virtual instruction is not an option for students that are enrolled in a non-virtual school. We do offer virtual programs here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools for secondary students. So that would not be an option. But we, of course, always work with any student who's absent for any reason in terms of making up assignments, opportunities to turn assignments in late, making sure that their education is not interrupted. We wouldn't do anything differently than we would for any other student.
So absenteeism, as I mentioned, rose substantially during the pandemic, and evidently, it continued. Has the level of chronic absenteeism, not related to ICE, just kids not coming to school, has that been brought back under control?
Yes. So it has decreased from 31.85% in the 21-22 school year to 25.46 in the 24-25 school year. We do not yet have, those are the most recent numbers. The other thing that I will say is that in addition to the chronic absenteeism rate decreasing, our overall attendance rate has increased significantly as well.
Okay. Let's talk about artificial intelligence. This is the buzzword right now. It's spreading faster than kudzu. This provides both challenges and opportunities in all walks of life and in all areas of business, and you name it, it's going to impact us all. How is it impacting educators and students today, and what do you see happening in the very near future?
Yeah, so we started this journey by asking our students, our families, and stakeholders what they thought about AI and how they wanted to proceed. We had over 10,000 responses, and in essence, they were very curious about AI and very cautious as well. And that speaks to the data privacy that I spoke a little bit earlier when we were talking about the immigration topic. But through that, we have a very clear vision statement as well as what we plan to do moving forward. So first of all, we are specific that AI will not be used to replace our amazing staff, but actually enhance the work that they're already doing. We're focused on making sure that our students become AI literate, meaning they understand the difference between generative AI and making sure that they're able to make decisions on when they see AI and how it may not be accurate. And then also how they are using AI responsibly and leading with that in the work that they do every day. So moving forward this year, we're, as I mentioned, said that we're moving very cautiously as well as being curious. And so what we've done is we've asked folks that are going to be our early adopters. We have 30 schools that are going to be our AI champions. We believe that the people that are closest to the work will help us understand this even more. So they will go through deep training. They will have access to specific AI tools. We plan to learn from them, iterate on what they learn, and then roll out more deeply next school year.
So this is a kind of pilot program in 30 schools to see how it works or how it can best be used.
Yes, and that's what will be will happen for those 30 schools as well as departments. We call them AI use cases that we will be studying and responding to. But everybody in our district will take what they will receive information, courses, they will have to take an assessment on AI literacy, focusing on data privacy. That is my biggest concern about the use of AI moving forward.
I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about just the use of AI that might impede a student's ability to understand how to do research and figure out what's right and what's wrong. Also, how they develop critical thinking skills and how they develop writing skills, because I know that Microsoft Word right now, today, with copilots built in, will say at the beginning of any document, "What would you like to write about?" And then it will write it for you. It's not very good, but it will write it for you. So how do you know students aren't using that as a crutch or as a tool that simply does their work for them?
Right. So this year we will be releasing guidance on what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in terms of use of AI for assignments. Our teachers will also be given guidance on how they navigate that because it is a different, difficult landscape. But to your point about critical thinking, as educators, we need to start thinking more deeply about how we are holding students accountable for the knowledge that they do learn. For example, if you're an English teacher and you are giving a research paper assignment, so students do that assignment, the best way to know how they did with that assignment is to give them an opportunity to speak to the work that they've done. You can't fake standing up and speaking to the research that you have done. So that would be a really good example of how you might use AI to pull articles, things together to help you formulate your thoughts more efficiently, but being able to deeply understand and then speak to it in a way that's intelligent and also answer questions is a higher level of thinking.
There
And that's what we would expect.
are concerns about whether AI makes mistakes. AI is not, and maybe it always will, but obviously it will get better over time. But it does make mistakes, and it has been known to take, most recently, Grok, a very political point of view. So, how do you protect students from believing what they see when they do these deep dives using AI to research, and they don't know? It's telling them Hitler was a good guy.
That's a great point. I actually listened to that podcast this morning as I was getting ready. So you are absolutely right, which is why we are launching our digital citizenship. That's a piece of the learning that will be included on data privacy, how to recognize if things are true, understanding that AI does have biases, and understanding that it's a big black box that, as we've recently learned, can't be figured out. So you cannot trust what you see.
I have about a minute left. You've said that the world of AI is not unlike the Wild Wild West, and that refers to your concerns over data privacy because everything on the internet tracks everything we do, every place we go, everything we look up on Google, etc. It's all tracked, and it can ultimately be traced back to us. Can you prevent tracking of students and the privacy that they deserve if they're going to be allowed to use, and they're going to use it anyway, AI?
So one of the things that we are focusing on is using generative AI that's closed, meaning that it would be less susceptible to biases. The other thing that we are super focused on is as we begin to engage with other vendors, making sure that their data privacy is tight and they are accepting our terms and conditions and not being very clear on how they are using any data and how data may be collected.
Are you confident? Is there a special product that is available to school systems around the country that is not available to the general public that allows you to do that?
We are working very closely with multiple entities before we roll out, which is why we are going slow and not going fast.
There's a lot more to talk about, and unfortunately, I have 15 seconds, so we won't even launch into it. Dr. Crystal Hill, Superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, a lot on your plate. Good luck, and thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.